Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There is a lot going on in the world of art. So let's check in with WBUR art supporter Maria Garcia. She's with The Artery. That's our arts and culture unit. Maria, it's good to see you.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Maria, first of all, let's start off with something that brings together the world of art and the law, because there's a case here in Massachusetts that could set some precedents for other places around the country. Earlier this week, the Supreme Judicial Court heard a single justice hearing where Justice David Lowy heard arguments in the case of the Berkshire Museum. So explain to us what's going on here.
This has been going on since last year, Meghna. The museum says it needs to sell 40 pieces of art, basically to stay afloat. They say they have no other choice. They either sell the art or they close. But critics say that the art was donated for the public good, meant for public view, and that the sale dishonors that intent, since the art would end up most likely in private collections.
I see. Now, and of course, also one of those pieces includes a Norman Rockwell painting that he personally donated to the museum. So this seems like it's a really big deal.
It's a really big deal, Meghna. I mean, the art world is watching Massachusetts in this case. And the thing is, Meghna, that selling artwork either to fund capital improvements or to balance budgets, it's just not something that cultural institutions do. It's pretty frowned upon. It happens very, very rarely. And the main reason is public trust. And so the concern is that these masterpieces will end up sold to the highest bidder, which will most likely be a private collector. So the art will hang in the private homes of wealthy people around the world instead of on view at public institutions. Mm. So here's Nicholas O'Donnell, an attorney representing residents opposed to the sale, who filed a brief as a friend of the court.
It is awful for me to contemplate that Massachusetts might be the place that sets the example that this sort of thing is okay. The temptation, I think, will be too much to bear for museums that have financial challenges, which many museums do.
Hmm. Interesting. But Maria, I mean, is it possible for people who are donating or even the museum itself to put a condition that the artwork can only be sold to other public institutions?
It's definitely possible. And here's where it gets tricky, Meghna. So the attorney general had originally sided with the opponents of the sale. But after a 7-month investigation, the AG is basically switching sides. It's siding now with the museum, saying, okay, yes, there are restrictions to these artworks, but the museum's finances are just too dire to consider them.
This is so interesting, because usually when museums are under some sort of financial stress, they may resort to a capital campaign or something like that. But how dire are the finances for the Berkshire Museum that it wants to take this kind of drastic step?
It's been operating under a $1.2 million annual structural deficit. And in court this week, the museum attorneys made this really impassioned argument to the court justice saying, look, many of the residents in Pittsfield live below the poverty line. The Berkshire Museum is their window to the world. The question here is, should this museum stay open or not? And the museum says they're sure that the only way for it to stay open is to sell the artwork.
Maria, this is such a fascinating case, right? Because at the core here, as you've been describing, there's this question of stewardship, right? People opposed to the sale say that the museum would be failing in its stewardship of making these wonderful masterpieces available for public view, right? That they are stewards of that artwork. But their view of stewardship is keeping the museum open. But I just want to take a step back here. I mean, 40 pieces of art, how much money are we talking about?
A lot of money. Estimates are that the sale of the artwork, which include two paintings by Norman Rockwell, will net at least $55 million, Meghna.
Wow, wow.
So it'll be interesting to see what the court decides. The decision could come as soon as next month.
As soon as next month. Okay, so we'll be keeping our eye on that. Really interesting case. Maria, let's move on to another big story that has to do with art institutions. This is the firing of Helen Molesworth from the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Now, before moving to L.A., Molesworth was chief curator at Boston's ICA. That was until 2014. And I talked to her a bunch of times on the show here, and I thought she was one of the smartest, most exciting curators I'd ever met. So What happened out in L.A.?
Yeah, a lot of people would agree with you. I mean, she's in curating world. I think she's considered a superstar. There's a lot of mystery to what happened. You know, MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A., has only said it parted ways with Molesworth because of creative differences, whatever that means.
Right.
But look, anyone who's followed her career knows she's an agent of change in the art world. She was very open about curating shows with women artists, artists of color. And even when she was in Boston, she was always trying to elevate the work of artists of color, though according to her, she did it in a bit of a sneaky way. Here she is in 2014 at the Hammer Museum in L.A. talking about her curating strategy.
At the ICA Boston, I realized that if I made certain arguments very explicitly about identity, that I would not be successful. And so I never made a stink about how I had systematically committed to shows by African-American women in the galleries.
This is where I'm confused about what happened in L.A. because, I mean, haven't museums in recent times been very vocal about championing exactly these sort of diverse kinds of shows and artists?
They have been vocal, Meghna, but that's different than actually doing the work, right? There's limited space in art museums. So if you want to highlight the work of people of color or people who have been historically left out of these spaces, sometimes you're going to have to leave out some artwork from those who have had access. And at MoCA, before her firing, Molesworth had been pretty vocal about being pressured by a white, wealthy male board to feature white male artists.
Okay, so this is interesting because Helen Molesworth's firing coincides with another woman doing sort of similar work, Laura Rykovich at the Queens Museum in New York, and she has been let go from there too?
Well, she left.
She left, okay.
She left, but she says that she left because the museum didn't support her vision. So Laura Rykovich, you know, she was a very outspoken director at the Queens. And earlier this year, she stepped down after pressure from the board. Rykovich was doing some really overtly political work, Meghna. She closed the museum during President Trump's inauguration. But what really caused her firing, according to a report from the museum, was that she, quote, improperly opposed hosting an event celebrating the founding of Israel, and that she didn't make it clear to the board that she was part of what they call a politically divisive book that supported the boycott of Israel.
Okay, so here we have two high-profile, you know, risk-taking female curators doing this daring work, and it seems as if, you know, whether people agree with it or not, that they have been pushed out of the art world, at least out of these two institutions, in just the span of a couple of months.
Yes, and I think people are still trying to figure out what that means, right? What does it say about the arts when these two women, who were essentially doing what the arts institutions say they want to do, putting on these thought-provoking shows, focusing on access to artists of color instead of white, established artists, and then just pushing the envelope? What does it say when these women were let go? And at the very least, I think, Meghna, it's an issue of really bad optics.
Mm. Well, one more story, Maria, before we go. And this one is about something near and dear to my heart or my head, curly hair. Because you reported a story about it this morning on Morning Edition about how curly hair can be an identifier of non-assimilation for many Latino women, right?
Yeah, that's right, Meghna. You know, the story is really about how our hair isn't just about us. It's also about how it makes others around us feel and how we're aware of that. You know, hair isn't just something that grows out of our head and has no meaning. It serves as an identifier, a way the world reads you. And in a world filled with biases, I think Latinas often change their curly hair to make themselves more approachable and more legible.
Mm. Well, let me ask you something, because in your story this morning, Maria, you actually made a specific point to say that you're not Afro-Latina. And I'm just wondering why you felt it was important to make that distinction.
Because I think that there are degrees of severity to the politics of hair. You know, even as a young child, I sort of intuitively understood that certain hairstyles were symbols of class, and that my curly hair marked me as more ethnic, less assimilated. But, you know, Meghna, I never feared getting expelled from school because of my hair, like some black girls have. And though all women of color, to a certain degree, have to contend with deviating from conventional Eurocentric beauty standards in the West, we know Black women are overtly discriminated for their hair and that there's a history of even legislating Black women's hair.
Hmm. Well, Maria Garcia is a reporter for WBUR's The Artery, and we've got links to all of Maria's story, including the one on curly hair, at radioboston.org. Maria, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.